well over 50% of the recordings that I have come from habitats that no longer exist. Either they're altogether silent or they've been transformed so radically by human endeavor that you can't hear the natural soundscape really anymore in those habitats. That's remarkable.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, the Executive Director, and today we are in for an acoustic treat. We're delighted to be joined by a remarkable individual who has actually made an indelible mark on the world by simply listening. For over 50 years, Bernie Krause has traveled to seven continents to meticulously capture the sounds of the natural world in all its diverse magnificence. In that time, Bernie has collected over 5,000 hours of recordings of natural environments, including 15,000 terrestrial and marine species. Through his work, he's established a new bioacoustic discipline, soundscape ecology, and encouraged us all to have a newfound respect for listening rather than always looking, and given us a vocabulary to describe what we hear. His soundscape installations have been enjoyed all around the world, and fortunately, we are lucky to have one visiting us right now near Boston. Thanks to the Fondation Cartier in Paris, the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem is currently presenting the Great Animal Orchestra. This amazing immersive audiovisual experience will be on display till May 2022. Well, actually, we're going to jump across now to California to welcome you, Bernie. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And congratulations on this exhibit. And in fact, on your life's work, which can't be underestimated, vast volume of material that you've been collecting for all of us, for posterity, really. So I know you didn't start out as a biologist. You started out as a musician. So I am very taken with the encounter that you did have with a Native American man who was on the Nez Perce Reservation, I think in Northeast Oregon, if I got that right, who told you that you white boys don't know anything about music back in the beginning of your career. So this kind of changed everything.
Well, he was right. And even though I had studied music and you know, was a composer and played almost all the stringed instruments, and we were working on the Nez Perce Reservation up in Idaho, which is just close to the northeastern corner of Oregon, which is also part of their territory. And there was an elder with whom we were talking one evening, and he suggested to me that if we wanted to learn something about music after he made that comment, that he would take us out the next morning and teach us how we got our music. Well, I was fascinated by that. I mean, I thought that was one of those teachable moments. And 4:30 in the morning, we got in the car and we drove for several hours to get to a sacred place of the Nez Perce called Lake Wallawa in northeastern Oregon, near Enterprise, Oregon, small town there. And he sat us down by the side of a stream and told us to just sit there and wait. Well, it was in October and it was up at about 7,000 feet and very cold. And we sat there for maybe half an hour or so, and we were getting hypothermic because we weren't dressed for that. And all of a sudden, there was this great wind that came down the valley from a feeder stream that was feeding that lake. And all of a sudden, there was this sound of, I guess you would best describe it as a great big pipe organ that began to excite the whole area around where we were sitting, especially. And finally, this elder walked up to us and asked us if we knew what was happening and where that sound was coming from. Of course, we didn't. So he said, come with me. And he walked us to the side of the stream. And you could see it just to the edge of the stream, the different length reeds that were broken off by the wind. And, you know, we scratched our heads for a moment, and then all of a sudden the light went on and we realized what was happening as the wind blew across the top of these reeds, the different length reeds. It excited them into sound. And the shorter ones were the higher pitched voices and the longer ones were the lower pitched voices. And that was where probably people were inspired to create the pan pipes, mm-hmm. you know, those pipes that are all along like that. And he said to us, he said, well, let me show you one other thing. And he walked into the stream and cut off a length of reed and bored some holes in it and then started to play. And he said, this is how we got our music. And that's how you got yours.
And you were forced to agree, I'm sure.
Then you say nothing. There's nothing you can say that's better than that.
So now you suddenly discover this magic that you've been missing. So how did it affect you going forward then, professionally and personally?
Well, I got started with this mostly because we had an album to do. It was our first album for Warner Brothers called In a Wild Sanctuary. In a Wild Sanctuary was the first album on the theme of ecology. It was also the first album ever to use natural sound as a component of orchestration. It came out in 1970. It meant that either Paul, my late music partner, or I had to go out into the field and record some sounds because we had nothing in our library for that. We were doing film scores and doing just sound effects with a Moog synthesizer. And off I marched into a local park north of San Francisco and turned on this recorder. Well, I have to tell you that that moment changed my life. The space opened up and I heard the natural soundscape for the first time in this amplified way, this surreal way. And I thought to myself, I really feel good. I feel relaxed. I feel connected to a world I hadn't really known before because I'd been working in recording studios without any windows. So we never had any connection to the outside world. Well, when I felt this way, listening to these sounds, because I have a terrible case of ADHD, I felt calm for the first time in a long time. And I thought to myself, I've got to figure out a way to do this for the rest of my life. I was 30 years old then. And the next 10 years was an effort to break away from music. And finally, after working on Apocalypse Now and getting fired 8 times, by the way, I got fired and then hired back. So at double the amount of money. So it worked out just fine. Anyway, after working on Apocalypse Now, I just quit music in 1979, went back to school, got my PhD in bioacoustics, which is recording sounds of living organisms, and I've never looked back.
So apart from it being so therapeutic for your ADHD, you said you were raised in a household which really wasn't big on animals and didn't like pets. And so how did you go from that kind of wild places being scary to this being a love affair with wilderness, which you feel totally at ease in now?
Well, it took a while because I was really afraid of the natural world and being outside. I was taught that it was dangerous and dirty, that you would die from disease if you weren't bitten and scratched to death. So I had to get over those fears. And little by little, I was able to do that. And certainly because being in the presence of these natural soundscapes and these biophonies, what I call biophonies, natural sound, that's the collective sound everybody hears in the natural world, it just made me feel good. And so I did it primarily in the beginning because I felt better physically, emotionally, psychically, I felt a lot better. So it didn't occur to me to really do this thing scientifically until I tried to figure out how I was going to make a living recording animal sounds and immediately hit on the idea of doing these soundscapes for museums and aquaria and zoos. And that's how I got involved in doing it seriously as a vocation.
So before we proceed and discuss the actual analysis of what we hear, when you've come up with these new terminologies for the world, really, I want to invite the audience to chime in at any point, either with questions or do you have favorite sounds? And are some of those sounds now gone?
There's actually two parts to that question. The first are my favorite sounds. I think my favorite place to record is Alaska because there are so few. There are 730,000 people in an area 3 times the size of France. So you can really get away from populations and people for long periods of time. It's like Bill McKibben says, when he tries to describe, he was asked once what he meant by wild. And his answer was, wild is a place where you can walk for 2 weeks in any direction and never hit a fence or a road. It's also a place where you don't see forest rangers telling you about the life cycle of a grizzly bear. And last of all, and best, it's a place where there's nothing to buy. And that's what he called wild. So wild is really important. The second part of that question is, I missed it. Go for it. Tell me again, Mary.
Yeah, we're talking about favorite sounds, and then have those environments disappeared? Some of those sounds actually, are they gone?
Well, my library consists of about 5,000 hours of material now in 1,100 different habitats. And what's remarkable about this collection is that well over 50% of the recordings that I have come from habitats that no longer exist. Either they're altogether silent, or they've been transformed so radically by human endeavor that you can't hear the natural soundscape really anymore in those habitats. That's remarkable. And that's just since 1968. It's a very short span of time. So we're losing living organisms and living environments at that rate.
That's staggering. That's very, very sad. So any of you who want to tell us your favorite sounds or the location of your favorite sound, I know that one thing I miss a great deal from England is larks going up in the morning, in the early morning, in the high sky. They go ascend and they sing, and it's just amazing, that sound.
Beautiful, beautiful recordings of those.
Okay, so let's go back to, before we talk about how you analyzed sounds and came up with this vocabulary, part of the problem now, apart from the actual sounds themselves disappearing, is that the cacophony that we've created in this noisy, busy, busy environment, mostly urban, but not entirely, has basically kind of zoned out a lot of the natural sounds. So we're attuned now, our ears, to the ping of a cell phone or some device going off or some technical unnatural sound. And we don't hear the bird songs as much. No. So you've written about this a bit in your latest book, The Power of Tranquility in a Very Noisy World. So what was the thinking behind that? What were you hoping to get people to pay attention to?
I wanted people to begin to listen again, and to listen to this, and to understand the way that the soundscape affects us. All of these sounds, these pings on our phone, and the ringtones, and all of the rest of the stuff that we are exposed to in terms of the acoustic world around us, is distracting. The news is distracting. Everything that we hear, all of the ads on television that we hear, or radio that we hear, are affecting us in profound ways, mostly distracting us and keeping us from understanding the things that we need to know, like how healthy the habitats that we live in are. You know, I mean, the more we're exposed to this stuff, the more pathological we become as a culture. And if you don't believe that, just watch the news.
And also the consumption of people that are basically trying to calm themselves and zone out. A huge industry of people trying to get away from it somehow, either meditating or, you know, taking whatever they need to take to sleep, because it's the background noise is fiercely loud, unless you're lucky enough not to live in a very urban environment.
Yeah, and the power of tranquility gives us some ideas about what we can do to mitigate that issue. The issues of loss of sleep, the issues of stress, and the role that noise plays in all of those things.
Let's listen to some of the soundscapes, these wonderful soundscapes that you get to enjoy at the museum. But before we do that, I wanted to ask you to just explain about the vocabulary that you had to invent, because there wasn't really any kind of vocabulary when you were talking about the narrative of the living world when you started. Yeah, so you talked about geophony, biophony, and anthropophony.
Anthropophony, but anthropophony will work. Anthropophony is okay.
So maybe you could just explain what these are and how they overlap in terms of sound.
Well, there's this wonderful composer and naturalist from Canada who just died last year by the name of Murray Schafer. And he invented the term soundscape in 1977 in his great book, Tuning of the World. And he described the soundscape as all of the sound that reaches our ears from whatever source. The problem is he didn't define the sources. The other problem is we're a visual culture. And as a visual culture, all of the things that we have to describe the world around us, all that vocabulary is visual. I mean, when I was scoring films, the director would come up to us and say, you know, I want this scene to be kind of red in color, or brown in color, or white in color. That's how they describe visually the acoustic world. Well, I thought to myself, well, Jesus, as a musician, I understand the Latin and Italian terms, that are the expressions are used in music, but we need some stuff to describe the sources of music. So the first source that I came up with a colleague by the name of Stuart Gage, from Michigan State University, a professor there, was the geophony. Geo meaning earth and phone from the Greek meaning sound. So sounds of the earth. And what by that I meant natural sounds like impressions of wind in the trees or grasses, water in a stream, waves at the ocean shore, movement of the earth, that kind of thing. So that was the geophony. And the geophony was around geophony was one of the first sounds on Earth around 4.5 billion years ago. But it wasn't until organisms began to evolve and be affected by and producing sounds about 55 million years ago that those sounds were able to be heard. And so when the organisms formed, I call that the biophony, the collective sound that's produced by all organisms in a given habitat at one place in one time. And then we had to think of, I had a special category for us because we're so damn noisy. And I called that anthropophony or anthropophony, anthropo meaning human and phone again meaning sound, so sounds humans produce. And that has two levels to it. One is controlled sound like music, theater, and language. And the other is incoherent or chaotic sound that I refer to as noise. And it's the noise that surrounds us that's really a problem. And we have to figure out a way to mitigate that. Most of those suggestions are part of the power of tranquility.
So first you have your soundscape made up of these elements. And then you have animated spectrograms, which give you a graphic illustration of the soundtrack, rather like an orchestra score. You can see what comes in and goes out. So you say that each organism finds its own kind of bandwidth in there, and it's got a little acoustic niche. And that's tonally, in terms of the full range of the scale, and then temporally, going in and out in space. So let's listen to, we've got 7 little clips from the exhibit at the PBD Essex, and the first one is the Amazon. That's a jaguar we're hearing.
The growl in the background is the jaguar. That's right.
So I don't know how close you have to get to a jaguar to get that.
10 meters in this case.
That's a whole book on its own, how you got these sounds, I think. The next one, I think, is probably my favorite, just because it sounds like a conversation between
I'd like to point out one thing, Mary. I'm sorry. What we do in the exhibit is we wanted to show a visual example, because we're a visual culture, I wanted to show a visual example of the sound. And that's the only way that we can do it, through the spectrograms. And you can see clearly where all of the animals fit in these acoustic niches, where they establish bandwidth for themselves. And the reason that they do that is so their voices won't be masked by other voices. So it's just like if you can imagine a musical score, it's just like a composer will score music so that the violins stay out of the way of the horns or the percussion. And it's all very carefully, I won't say orchestrated, because that's a little bit too presumptuous, but all of these animals, in order to thrive, have to find their own niche in order to survive. The acoustic niche is their establishment of territory.
So the second one, I think, is, I love whales anyway. So I think this is humpback whales, and they sound like they're having a conversation. I guess that's another whole life's work, somebody discerning what all that clicking and singing it is.
Well, the singing are the humpback whales, and recorded off Hawaii, off of Maui. And the other sounds, the clicking and the popping that you hear, are fish. And there are about 30 different species of fish in this soundtrack, because they make up part of the soundscape of the marine environments. And it's very important to know that. We have 200 species of fish recorded.
Wow. And you have that clicking noise is also the whales, the clicking.
A clicking noise is the fish.
Fish?
Yeah, gnawing on coral.
It's loud.
Yeah, it is loud, you bet.
So we've got a ton of questions coming in, but so we can't play, I don't think, all of these, but the wolves are rather nice. This is the Algonquin wolves, I think.
Algonquin Park is just north of Toronto, about a few hundred miles north of Toronto. And it's a wonderful park that goes all the way up in Ontario, all the way up to the north. And there are still wolves there. And they are wild and kept wild. And they don't shoot them or hunt them in Algonquin Park. They let them live. And there were two packs, by the way.
I'm not sure I'd like to hear it on my own.
Oh, actually, I was between two packs of wolves that were converging on one another, and it was the most extraordinary moment of my life. I think if one moment stands out in recording this stuff, it's seeing the color of their, being close enough to see the color of their eyes and being able to record them without feeling endangered. It never even occurred.
How did you not feel endangered?
It said they weren't being aggressive.
So actually, that's one of the questions someone said over here. Have you got a story about a personal interaction with a creature who interacted with you through their sound while you were present?
We just did.
Right. She said she had a moment with a wood thrush. The other thing you talked about was, it's as if you refer to a divine harmony in a healthy natural ecosystem with everything occupying its own little acoustic space.
Yeah.
And you said it was your religion at one point, as though it was almost sacred.
Well, these sounds are sacred to me. When I'm in a forest, which is wild and still vibrant with wildlife and expressing itself as a healthy environment. That's as close to the divine as I've ever got. I can't imagine being in a church or a mosque or a synagogue or any other, you know, place that we call religious that's had a stronger impact on me. I mean, the sounds of the natural world are to me the voice of the divine. And they, you know, these are the Sermons on the Mount. These are these are the homilies that we need to hear.
So you're saying a healthy soundtrack sounds one way, and then a stressed ecosystem sounds sort of chaotic.
Yeah. Yes. If you take a look, because in a stressed system, all of the animals are competing for bandwidth with one another, and they often overlap until they finally, work out where their space is going to be acoustically. And in a healthy habitat, the discrimination between all the sounds, between the insects and the frogs and the birds and the mammals, the discrimination between them is not only easily heard, but also you can see the clear imprint on these spectrograms, which is why we show the spectrograms in the museum. Because this graphic illustration of sound, this narrative of place, as we call it, is really important to understand and to know, and which is why we've been doing this work for so long now, and why it's beginning to have an impact on people, and create a document for people who are looking for habitat management and healthy habitat management. We have examples of that. So this is what you try to aim for.
Gosh, I'm torn here. We've got a lot of people asking questions, and we've got some people asking to hear more of your clips. So maybe we should at least play at least one more of your clips. I know we've got...
It's about the Dzanga-Sanga rainforest.
Yeah, the elephants, yeah.
This is a group of social sounds that the elephants are expressing, and they've gathered around this, what's called a bai, which is a B-A-I, which is a swamp. It's partly a salt lick as well. And so they get salt from the earth and the water. And this is why they gather there. This whole herd, it was maybe 20 animals, has been poached now. It's all gone. Because of people from Cameroon and nearby, the poachers from nearby forests. So a lot of these animals have been poached for ivory. These are great forest elephants. They're really remarkable animals.
Forum is made possible through the generosity of Dorothy and Herbert Vetter, the Lowell Institute, the Mass Cultural Council, and you. If you'd like to donate and or sign up for our members list, please visit the website cambridgeforum.org. There you will also find podcasts of this and other programs. So thank you all again for joining us. Thank you, Bernie.
Bye-bye.
See you soon.